Well, hi there, I'm Jonathan Doyle from beingcatholic.com.au. Great to have just a moment of your time. I wanted to bring you something really special this week, and it's an interview with someone who I think is one of the most interesting thinkers and communicators on Catholic education in the world today. I know that's a big rap, and he would blush that I've said that, but a really interesting man who has spent years upon years working in the vineyard of Catholic education, and his name is Dr. Gerard O'Shea. Dr. O'Shea currently lectures at both the John Paul II Institute in Melbourne and also at Notre Dame University. But he'll take you through all that. But I hope you can just download the podcast, use the download link underneath, or you can listen to it live on the page. But it'd be great to pop it on your iPod, your phone, have a listen in the car on the way home. He says some really important things here that I think are going to help you to become the educator or the leader in Catholic education that we really need you to be. I'd love if you could pass this on. I think the more people that hear this and get access to this great content, the better the whole experience of Catholic education is going to be, both for us as parents, educators and leaders, and crucially for our young people. I'm Jonathan Doyle at beingcatholic.com.au. Sit back and enjoy this interview with Dr. Gerard O'Shea. It's my great privilege this morning to be talking to Dr. Gerard O'Shea from the John Paul II Institute in Melbourne, who's been a good friend and guide in some ways for quite a few years now, and I'm sure we're going to have some interesting things to discuss. Gerard, I thought we'd just talk a little bit about your journey first, just so the listeners can get a sense of, we'll get to what you're doing at the moment, but can you tell us a little bit about the journey, the adventure you've had in Catholic education so far?
It's been a grand adventure, and it's gone on for far too long. I'm joking there, I hope you understand. I began teaching in a Catholic school in 1977. That's a long time ago. I don't want to tell you how long. You can work it out. But I've always taught in Catholic schools and began in primary school in Townsville and then spent another 16 years or so teaching in Catholic schools in Brisbane before becoming a principal in a remote New South Wales town in the Riverina, Ganmain. And I think that's where my teaching understanding really began. When you're the principal of a school of 46 children and have to do everything, you really do come to terms with what you can do and what you can't.
So this was multitasking in the era before multitasking.
Oh, ask anybody who ever tried it where they really learned to teach, and it would be in a country school where you were everything.
Correct.
And I was even the janitor.
And Ganmain is one of our former archbishops, Francis Carroll's from out that way, isn't he? It's some pretty tough footy country too, isn't it?
Oh, indeed it is. And it was much more difficult for me as a Queenslander to understand what was going on there.
Correct.
But I did. I got on top of it. Now, from Ganmain, I moved to Melbourne with my family. Anne and I have five children, but then we only had four. We have one Victorian child now. And I took up some work with the Archdiocese of Melbourne to help write the RE texts to Know, Worship and Love, which was, again, an extremely interesting experience and one where I learned a lot. It was there that I first came into proper contact with an understanding of Catechesis of the Good Shepherd, the work of Sophia Cavaletti, which I've been involved with ever since. I then became principal of two further schools, Corpus Christi at West Footscray and St. Patrick's at Mentone, two very different schools. So my experience has covered, I suppose, virtually every educational context in our country.
Give us a couple of highlights. What have, over that journey before you've, moved out of, I guess, the front line as such in terms of day-to-day leadership inside a Catholic school, what have been a couple of highlights in the journey so far?
Oh, too many to mention. Every year has been a highlight because every year you start again with a new group of children. Yeah. And the children, of course, are always the highlight if you're going to enjoy teaching. If you don't, it's just not going to work. You have to like it because otherwise it's too hard.
I've often said there's no such thing as a bad kid. Do you think that's true?
Yes and no. You just have to work harder if they're not cooperating.
Okay.
All right? And certainly they can do bad things. Let's not be delusionary about that.
What do you miss about being a principal?
Oh, I miss the contact. I might surprise you. One of the things I miss, of course, you'd expect, I miss the children. But when you're in a school, there's something very different that happens that doesn't happen in other workplaces. There's a kind of community dimension in Catholic schools. It really does set up this kind of beautiful community of teachers. I actually miss that. And when I get the opportunity to go back into staff rooms where I've been a part of it, I really relish it. You actually begin to mix with people in an ongoing way to understand what they're going through, understand their lives, and that human contact is not always possible in other workplaces.
I often, listening to you there, I often wonder if Catholic educators are really in touch with that kind of X factor that you're talking about. Because without being unfairly critical of other educational systems, I spoke to a principal recently and, you know, we were talking about doing some professional development work, and he said nobody stays past 3:30. He said they're just never. You never do PD after school. And I was struck that Catholic communities of teachers often just have that sort of stronger sense of, I guess, of what you just said, of that there's something there, isn't there? There's a community
formed.
I'm stunned
by what you said. Yeah. I'm a bit amazed that teachers wouldn't be there after school for one another. That was never my experience in any Catholic school I worked in.
No, this was outside of Catholic schools. This was actually in government education, and that's what the contrast was. And I didn't want to be unfairly critical of some of the good work government educators do, but I think what I'm getting at is what you said is that there's sort of an X factor there, isn't there? There's something about a Catholic Christian, a Catholic gospel-centered school community.
There definitely is, and you don't really understand what it is until you don't have it anymore.
Yeah. Well, let's move on from, you know, a little bit of that experience to what you're doing now. What are you doing day to day?
Oh, well, people tell me that I'm insane, but I have a number of different jobs that I'm trying to work at the moment. My work here at the John Paul II Institute in Melbourne is probably what you'd call the dream job for somebody who loves religious education. I'm the senior lecturer in religious education here. I run the Certificate of Catechesis and Religious Education program. That's great, coming up against many really fine young teachers who are absolutely dedicated to doing a good job and are producing extraordinary materials that I'd like to promote around the country when I get the opportunity. My research in this area, of course, is in the field of religious education, and I've started to do the academic thing. I've published in a number of journals in Australia and overseas. But the part I enjoy most here is visiting schools to promote good practice in religious education. Another thing I do is kind of what you do. I give talks to parents on how they might form their own children in sexuality. Except that I tend to target the group that I'm used to, parents of children in primary school. Hmm. Okay, so there's that part of it. I also work at the University of Notre Dame in Sydney twice a week, 2 days a week, as associate professor in religious education. What I do there is extremely interesting, and it's great to be part of what's happening at that exciting and dynamic young university. I get to speak to, on an ongoing basis, 110, 120 primary school RE teachers. And I think the future is well assured if what I'm seeing there is replicated around the country. It's a very fine institution doing great work. From there, I also accept invitations to various dioceses around the country to work in RE. So I've had invitations in the last 12 months from Wagga and Lismore and Armidale and Parramatta. But if you get to the heart of what I really like doing, some years ago I set up Catechesis of the Good Shepherd Victoria to promote the work of Sophia Cavaletti. And that, if you want to ask me about that later on, you more than most know that I'm capable of going on about that for more than an hour and a half before I notice that people have made for the door.
Yep. Well, tell me, when I was listening to you talk about your work, I wonder if so many of us overlook that the great battles of culture are often, as we say, won in the academy, that it's what happens in our tertiary institutions that shapes the next generation of graduates coming through. And we know that the work of, obviously, Nietzsche and Freud and people that we've looked at the Institute. So what are we doing in our tertiary Catholic institutions at the moment that's working?
Well, I can only talk about what I know, and I don't want to think of other institutions. I know that what we're doing at the John Paul II Institute is to work in a very refined kind of way in addressing those cultural issues, to think it through, to come up with arguments that are answers to it. But my personal view is that that will never be enough. On one level, human beings need logical answers, but on another level, they need this dimension of faith that's intangible. The two have to go together. And so I'm in that unique position where I can do both. I can reach out catechetically. I can reach out particularly to children. And I teach once a week in a Cavaletian atrium for about 2 hours. And that grounds me. That brings me back to earth. It helps me understand whether the theories that I'm espousing really do work. So that's what we're trying to do at the John Paul II Institute.
It's interesting hearing you talking about the atrium work. Like, as some listeners would know, I've got a very young family and I've got two kids at the moment doing the catechesis of the Good Shepherd stuff, and it's just quite extraordinary to actually to come and pick them up and just to see them there and knowing that we're being able to communicate something, you know, and just such an intelligent way to do it. So a couple of quick ones for you was... you know, this could this will get you thinking. And what do you think are the two most pressing issues that Catholic education faces at the moment?
Oh, you've pressed the right button, Jonathan. I know straight away. I think there are two. The first one is identity, Catholic identity in Catholic education, and the second one is our failure to realize the attractiveness of the good news. I'll talk to the first, identity. I really believe that in Catholic institutions, we're in danger of succumbing to a secular vision. But we're better than that. We just have so much more to offer than secular society has. But in Catholic schools, we are always in danger of seeing the faith just as an add-on. And that's because of the pressures of what's demanded of us in educational circles now. But Catholic education always works best when it's an activity that's driven by our faith in Christ and the Church. If we drive Catholic education from a secular vision and then try to drag in bits and pieces of what the Church teaches along with it, the whole thing doesn't hang together properly. So that, to me, issue of Catholic identity, where Christ really and truly is at the center of what we do, is the most important challenge facing Catholic education. Hmm. Now, the second one is by dint of ongoing onslaughts from the secular press, the secular media, from the world around us, we can lose the understanding of how attractive the good news really is. If we're continually on the back foot, being forced to answer objections, you know, what about this priest who did that? What about this terrible thing that happened there? Then we lose the fact that we've got something much better than that. So my solution to that is to step around it and continually talk about what's great and happy in our relationship with Christ and the Church. And so if you lose the balance there, if the negatives and the reactions take over what you're trying to do, then that damages the whole process of Catholic education.
And I wonder if you'd agree or disagree with this about the concept of signs of life. Like, I'm noticing, obviously, with the reading and the things that I'm across, you know, we're getting some great bishops, like, you know, overseas, Chaput, Dolan in New York. We have some good ones coming online in Australia. there is a resurgence, isn't there? I mean, maybe it's not widely known, but listening to you talk about your optimism and some of the students that you're seeing come through, years ago at a conference in Singapore, I was talking to a guy who was the head of the whole economic infrastructure for DHL couriers in Asia, and he joked with me. He said, "I don't often get to work on the positive side of the ledger,"
exactly,
which basically meant his job was to go around all day cutting costs all the time. But I often think, you know, like you just said, we can spend a lot of time looking at, you know, what's not working, but there is some signs of life, isn't there?
Absolutely, signs of life. And, you know, that's not what you'll get from the media. What you get from any journalistic enterprise is the view that negative news sells. And so if that's at the forefront of what we're doing, then you can be overwhelmed by the negative. And it's not true. It's not true. If you look at the things that are happening in any life and in any family, the good things will always be much greater than the bad. But the good things are not what you're going to hear about.
No, correct. Now, this next question is a real favourite of mine with my sort of business background, and I'll give you a scenario here that tomorrow all the bishops meet in plenary and they decide that they're going to take the entire budget for Catholic education and they're going to give it to Dr. Gerard O'Shea to do with as he wills. What major initiative or, you know, funding stream, where would you put the money?
Oh, my God. How insane would the bishop be if they did that? They need to be much more prudent than that.
Yep.
Look, I suppose the question you're asking presumes that massive injections of money can solve our problems. You and I know that that's not true. Mm. Otherwise, the wealth of anybody would solve the crisis of everything. Jesus would have arrived with bags of money and distributed it. But that's not where it is. The only genuine conversions that happen are those that work on the heart. But look, to be fair and answer your question, I think there are some things that work better than others. And I think that's what you're asking, isn't it? What really works?
Yeah.
Okay. Firstly, I think that you have to adapt the message to the developmental stage of and experience of the audience. In other words, you've got to look at who you've got and what they need. And there are a lot of things that can be done. We've already mentioned catechesis of the Good Shepherd. I think that's one of the processes, one of the programs in this country and in the world at the moment that is most likely to succeed in winning over the youngest children to the message. But we can't leave it there, can we? We've got to go on and think of what works in adolescence. And my understanding is this, that you've got to believe in their idealism and you have to harness it with genuine challenges. And I like to use World Youth Day as an example of what can be done with adolescence. The main task of adolescence is a task of self-discovery. This is something that Montessori described. This is something that anybody who works with adolescents really understands, that what they need to do is discover things for themselves. Montessori described every adolescent as on an odyssey, on a journey. Now think about what happens in World Youth Day. They go off on a journey. It's really difficult. They don't go with their parents. They go with their friends. And there's the other element of adolescence, isn't it?
Yeah.
They care about what everybody else thinks. If you put them together with a whole lot of other fine young people where you give them a challenge that's really difficult, they're fine with it as long as they're doing it together. Hmm. Four of my five children have gone off to World Youth Day at one stage or another, and every one of them has come back talking about, oh, we did this, for example, in Cologne. We were walking out to the place where the mass was held, for example, and on the way back, all the trains broke down, so we had to walk miles and miles and miles after midnight in the dark. I said, oh, awful. No, it was great. It was great. In Toronto, we were waiting for the mass to start, and a thunderstorm broke over the top of us while we were sleeping out in the open. How awful. No, it was the most fun I've ever had. All of those things, all of the things that go wrong and that challenge them, help them to discover who they are.
Yeah.
So we're not helping our young people by not challenging them,
mm-hmm.
nor are we helping them if we don't allow them to work things out with each other. So, you know, all of those things need to be adapted. You don't sit adolescents down in a classroom and make them learn off propositions and all of those answers. Theirs is a very physical, outward focus. Adults. My dad had a saying. He died last year at the age of 92.
Yeah.
And he used to say of the things that I was doing, you don't need to argue too much. Just lay a straight stick beside it. Okay? So he used to say that if you see a crooked stick, you don't bother running around telling everybody that the stick is crooked. You just lay a straight stick beside it. And so time and again, I've seen that in work that I've done in schools as a principal, particularly in that really vexed area of sexuality education, where you think you're going to get a whole lot of resistance. But when you get the time to explain what the church's vision of sexuality really is, in 10 years, I've never had a single person come up and challenge me. And I've had lots of different audiences. Mostly what I get is, I really didn't understand that the church taught that.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful, isn't it? So this is what we've got to retrieve. We've got to retrieve the view that we've got incredibly good things to offer. Understand that and present it. And always worked in the past.
For years now, I've claimed that I invented this phrase. I haven't heard of anybody else coming up with it. So for years, I've been saying in staff seminars, said, you know, that the Catholic Church has the greatest product in the world with the worst marketing department. It's like Apple in California, you know, having the most amazing products, but you know, a couple of monkeys working in the marketing department. So another one that occurs to me. I wanted to wrap up in a second, talk about the upcoming things at Notre Dame, but I'm noticing a lot of the staff PD stuff. We've got a whole generation of 20-something people coming into the profession who would be what I would broadly call people of goodwill, in that John Paul II sense, who may have come from a government university, a secular university, and who are not in any way antagonistic or resistant to the church's message, but have no formation in it. I mean, they're happy to sign off saying that they'll support it. And in the same room, I've got obviously some cynics who may be burned out. And but let's talk a little bit about the people of goodwill. How do we, and people will be listening to this in that category, who are just interested and supportive, and how do we tap into, motivate, evangelize, channel and harness that big new demographic coming into Catholic schools?
I think we've got lots of good opportunities there. And like yourself, I've seen people like that turned around. But you have to understand that you have to deal with them as individuals.
Yeah.
Every one of them is a unique individual, and even in the general directory of catechesis, we hear that these people who are adults have been formed by their life experiences. And so you can't just get a blanket program together and say, oh, this is what will work. You've got to listen to people to find out where they are, to detect what it is that they need. Now, Thomas Aquinas, Maria Montessori, Sophia Cavalletti, all have this basic understanding of what human learning has to do. They all say that it starts with the senses, with concrete analogies. So if you're trying to reach somebody of goodwill, you can't normally start with catechism answers to vexed questions. You've got to start with their understanding of the fact that God is in their lives. And it was von Balthasar, the theologian, who alerted us to the starting point. Starting point is what is beautiful. They have to encounter in the world that they live in things that are beautiful, things that take them out of themselves. And Cavalletti would call that starting with the body, with the senses. She would say that starting with the senses in a religious education sense means, first of all, looking at the beauty of creation itself and wondering at it. And then looking at the concrete liturgical realities that sum up the life of Christ. Cavaletti then says you move on to the heart. And that's what I'm suggesting we do in evangelization. We start with the concrete things, the things of the senses. Then we move on to the heart. What is it that wins the heart over once you've got them ready? Traditionally, it has always been the scriptures and prayer, allowing them to access the actual words of Christ in the scriptures themselves is what will draw them into a relationship with him, then nourished by prayer. And it's only after you've dealt with those two things, the senses and the heart, that you're ready to move on to the mind. You don't start with arguments. The mind is there to bring together the things that the body and the heart have worked on. I'm currently supervising a PhD thesis of an extremely intelligent young priest who's come up with what we all know in the works of Newman, a relationship between what he calls implicit and explicit reason. And to cut to the chase, what does that mean? It means that we understand more than we can say. And that's particularly so in a child. And everybody out there understands more than they know. They feel things. There's something there that they can't quite express. And if we try to put words around it too soon, then we're missing what they're trying to bring out of themselves. So that's a thumbnail sketch.
There is about 6 months of interviews in that last thing you said. I was actually really moved. I thought, there's so much there. I was, as you were just finishing there, you know, the stuff about beauty. And for so long, I've been just thinking with schools, both with young people and with staff, you know, a couple of things is that, you know, what's the one thing that young people are not getting in this incredibly advanced technological society is the complete inability for silence. And where's a place where they could encounter silence, contemplation, you know, and that ties into liturgy. We get liturgy ugly, we get liturgy wrong, we get a whole bunch of flow-on effects. And, you know, that hearing you talk about beauty in the person is, you know, I fly into Sydney sometimes several days a week, and, you know, it's fascinating to look at all these apartments jammed right onto the water's edge. And from a plane, you've got that different view, and you sort of think, what is it about the human person that wants to be in close connection with, you know, something like beauty and the beauty of nature? And it's only when you get up to that, you know, 10,000 feet, when you look down and you just see this movement of, you know, tens of thousands of people. And I guess our Catholic tradition offers us a chance to, I think what you said there, that synthesis, that movement from experience, you know, and beauty into the mind, synthesizing that into something really meaningful.
Indeed, yes. Look, St. Thomas Aquinas had it right, as he usually does in a single sentence, that all education begins with a sense of wonder.
Oh, yeah.
And Cavaletti added to that by saying, and wonder begins with an attentive gaze at reality.
Wow.
Because all reality is created by God.
Yeah.
And the deeper the reality, the more likely you are to connect with God. Mm. Standing in front of a sublime waterfall, or waves crashing on the shore, or even a flower unfolding in the morning sun, all of those things have within them the vestigial presence of God, the attractiveness of beauty. The more you look at it, the more you wonder.
So let's move from the sublime philosophy to the shameless plug part of our interview. And I actually really wanted to do this too, because some listeners wouldn't be aware, we've got a fantastic intensive up at Notre Dame starting on the 9th of July. I'm going to be there myself, which is great. I'll bring the family up and have a week up there and listen to you for a week, so you'd better be very good. I mean, it is a long journey for me, so I'm looking forward to that.
Well, don't delude yourself.
But this is, I guess, for all those staff here, maybe in this country, for RECs or deputies, principals, RE staff, or, you know, people of goodwill who'd be interested in getting some very deep formation. This 1 week intensive here is going to be really powerful. So tell us a little bit about what's actually going to be happening there.
Okay, thanks for that, Jonathan. There are two aspects to it, of course. There's a one-week intensive, a subject called Critical Issues in Religious Education. But what we wanted to do was to make it much broader than that and to open the first 2 days up to everybody in the community. So the first 2 days of that intensive are actually a conference of Catholic religious educators. And that means anybody who's a teacher, a CEO staff member, a parent, a catechist, all of it is presented in such a way that you can access it. And to start with, we're going to go through those developmental stages identified by Montessori and Cavalletti, identifying the different levels, the different needs at different age groups, and what people may have missed out on by not going into each of those at the right time. On the second day, we will then talk in really practical terms. What are some practical activities that we can use to bring out those needs at different levels? And we have other people attending to assist us with that. We have the CEO directors of RE for Parramatta and for Sydney. We have the family coordinator from the Diocese of Broken Bay, Jeanette Davidson. We have Dan Hill, who's got he's the chaplaincy coordinator for tertiary education in Sydney, and he has advanced qualifications in art, and so he will be able to talk to us, particularly in a secondary school, about what art can do to bring out the best in religious education. So there's that aspect of it, and then we will move on to more complex issues. But the first 2 days, that's open to everyone.
And how do they? What's the simplest way for people to get more information online? How can they track it down?
Online, contact the University of Notre Dame Sydney School of Education. Yep. And if you do that, they will be able to directly put you in touch with where you'll find it online. I haven't actually done it online, isn't it?
No, that's fine. And people can also just email me through the website here at Being Catholic. And I think I've got the flyers, the electronic ones, so I'd be happy to send those on. Okay, well, so that's an option there for people. I have a feeling there are many good interviews to come, so I'm probably going to tap you on the shoulder for a few more. But thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, John.
If you could say one thing to Catholic educators listening to this today in terms of encouraging them or something to think about, what would you say?
Oh, just tell them that the message they have is the most beautiful, most wonderful cause that's ever been known, and it will never change.
Dr. Gerard O'Shea, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Well, there you go. Some fantastic insights there from Dr. Gerard O'Shea. You know, I'm actually looking forward to downloading it myself and chucking it on the iPod on another of my crazy runs. Some of you will be aware I'm a mad keen runner, and I think I just want to listen to that again. There's some powerful points there. There's some really strong insights about the role of beauty and experience and how the mind can synthesize that. Some great simple strategies about what we can do in this great journey together of Catholic education. I would love you to pass this on to a friend, a colleague. I think the more people in your school that can access these kinds of ideas, the better. Make sure you check back on the website at beingcatholic.com.au. Make sure you've signed up for our regular updates. And if you'd like us to come and run some sessions with your staff, check out the seminars page or send me an email. I'll be straight back in touch. I'm Jonathan Doyle at beingcatholic.com.au. I look forward to speaking with you again really soon.